Quick question from me and the Making Money team. Would you like us to come into your workplace to teach you and your colleagues more about personal finance? It's an absolute joke that we're not taught what to do with money, and this knowledge gap makes most people much poorer over their lifetimes. Take your work-based pension. Most people have no idea what the fund they're invested in does, and plenty of people just opt out altogether. We can cover whatever is most important, from the basics to complex financial retirement planning supported by qualified financial advisors who are not there to sell you anything. We take different approaches for different people in a company depending on stuff like their age or their income. Anyway, if you think people you work with could benefit from financial education, then please email Will at getmost.co.uk so he can explain more. It doesn't matter what your role is in the business, we want to hear from you. So email Will at getmost.co.uk.
Just before we get into this episode, I wanted to let you know that we had a bit of an issue with one of the mic stands. During this fantastic conversation, you might hear some knocking, which is when Paul taps his hand on the table. We are aware of this and we're going to sort it out for future episodes.
Income tax at the moment is going up by the most it has ever gone up. And that's probably a £50 billion tax rise. Now, that's one of the biggest tax rises in history.
Paul Johnson is the director of the Institute for Fiscal Studies, the IFS. They're an independent research body who, among other things, look at how the government gets its money, like tax, and how they spend it. He's written a book called Follow the Money, How Much Does Britain Cost? It lays out exactly what the government does with our hard-earned cash and why it's going to need a lot more of it in the future. If you're like me, you'd have heard that and gone, I pay enough tax. Well, Paul's book really gave me a different perspective, and I wanted to give you guys a chance to hear his arguments too.
The population is getting older. Second thing, of course, is climate change. There's a dirty little secret in Whitehall, which is that they know how to do it and don't. We need to get the economy growing, and there are things that we can do to do that. But actually, that's going to take not just politicians to be brave, that's also going to take us to be brave.
I found the book a hard read, honestly, in a sense of it challenged my internal narratives around taxation. What I mean by that is, the book is about taxation, how we spend money or how the government spends money in the UK. And really this underlying message of we're probably all going to need to pay more tax in the future. And I think that goes against my, everyone thinks they pay enough or they think they pay too much. That's what we want to explore today. The reasoning in there, because you convinced me wholeheartedly. Can we just start by getting an explanation of you of what you do at the IFS and kind of what the IFS do, please?
Yeah, so we're, I'm glad that challenged you, but we're a research organisation. Yeah. We do work on what we think of as the economics of public policy. So that means looking at tax, welfare, pensions, health spending, education spending, local government finance, all those kinds of rather boring sounding things, but actually the things absolutely determine how we live, how government gets its money, how it spends its money. And we do all of that by doing lots of research on huge data sets. I mean, my colleagues spend all of their time analysing vast data sets to try and get an objective sense of how things are changing, what the difference government policy makes to people, and so on. We're an educational charity, and we try to be as completely objective and independent as we can.
How do you interact with the government then when you say independent? What does that mean?
Well, it means we sort of talk to government and opposition. It means we say when we think things aren't working or that policies are not going to achieve the sorts of things that they want them to achieve. When the numbers look to us a bit dodgy, we'll say so. But a lot of it, as I say, is doing our research and then putting that out into the world. We get quite a we're quite unusual, and we get lots of stuff in really high level academic publications, journals and so on. But we also talk through people like you, the BBC, ITV and the newspapers to try and put the information out into the world. So what we're trying to do is kind of bring those two together, bring the real academic rigor to the big public policy issues and get that into the public domain so people can make their own judgment about these things.
We hear things from politicians and without any sense or context, it riles you up. When I heard you talk in the book or through the audiobook and your words, it made sense.
Good.
And it's a shame that we don't get that sort of communication. I was showing my partner the book as well, and she said it reminded her of around COVID when the doctors were speaking and, you know, when they were talking around the policies around COVID, and we brought out experts who stood there and said, we need to do this because of this. She said she felt reassured by hearing the experts speak, and often she doesn't feel reassured by hearing politicians speak.
if that makes sense.
That completely makes sense. Yeah. I mean, of course, you know, experts can disagree and experts can have their own sort of view of the world, but we know that politicians are coming at it from a particular point of view, and they'll very often use, as you say, not put things in context. I mean, this is not a political point, but the most recent thing I can recall is that the Labour Party conference, for example, Rachel Reeves stood up and said, "We're going to use £1 billion from our non-dom tax to reduce to increase the number of appointments in the NHS." Now, £1 billion in an NHS budget of 180 billion is almost neither here nor there, and the number of appointments she was talking about out of the hundreds of millions that happen across the NHS is also sort of neither here nor there. But it sounds good, £1 billion and a million appointments.
Like a
but actually, one of the things I want to try and get across in that book is, you know, numbers that sound big aren't always big. No. Actually, if you're looking at the NHS, £1 billion is a tiny number. I know a billion here, a billion there, and seeing you're talking serious money, but you know,
lunch money for you too.
Pocket change.
But you know, when we spend 180 billion, you know, a billion is obviously useful, but it's not game changing. A billion for something like the justice system is a lot of money because that's a much smaller budget to start with.
What did you think of the book too?
I was about to say, like, the book kind of puts things into perspective. The beginning was talking about where tax started, and initially we didn't have tax, and then because of the wars,
taxes started in war.
It started in war,
and everyone promised to get rid of it.
Yeah.
And then it was like,
it did go away though. I think at the beginning you said it was only for people earning over £200 who got taxed, and then after like the French war, tax was abolished, income tax was abolished, and then it came back again, and then just slowly been creeping up over time. So is it just a cycle now? Do you think that it's just going to continually increase?
Well, it does. It has ratcheted up in sort of lumps over time. So as you say, I mean, we had the Napoleonic Wars quite a long time ago, and that's when income tax was first introduced, and then taxes went up a lot again after the First World War, and then after the Second World War. And the thing that's really surprising, and I sort of knew, but kind of really doing the book kind of lodged it in my head, is I haven't really changed much since the end of the Second World War until the last few years. So,
what do you mean by that? Sorry.
So we sort of, you know, if you look at tax as a fraction of national income, so you take all the national income and how much of that goes in tax, that's been pretty steady for a long time, about a third of national income. And that's quite surprising given that we're spending lots more on health and pensions and all those sorts of things than we were 50 years ago. And the main part of the reason we've managed to get that trick out is that we've basically massively cut defence spending.
So we
spent much, much less on defence and use that money to spend more on health and pensions and welfare and all those sorts of things, which broadly speaking, until very recently, has kept taxes as a fraction of national income pretty stable. But actually, they've jumped in the last 4 or 5 years by 3 or 4% national income, but by about £100 billion. Now that is
a big number.
That's quite a big number. Quite a big number. There's a reason for that, which is that we're spending lots more on health. There are more people over pension age, and we're spending more on pensions. We had a decade through the 2010s of really cutting spending hard on lots of other things, and there's not obviously you can do that much more. Economic growth has been rubbish. And we're spending a vast amount of money on debt interest payments because we've got a very big debt. So put all of those things together, and the government, and it doesn't want to. I mean, Conservative governments don't want to raise tax, but it has basically been forced into really big tax rises over this parliament.
How do we compare to our peers then? Because you focus on that in the book, the OECD and stuff. How do we stack up there?
So if you compare us with most of Western Europe, even though we've got our highest tax level ever, it's still below most of Western Europe, and a long way below places like France and Scandinavia, but below, you know, Germany, the Netherlands, all those sorts of countries. They tend to have much more generous pension systems, especially, but also quite often more generous welfare systems generally. So they tax quite a lot more than we do. But as with many things, we're a bit in the middle. So we tax a bit more than, or rather more than, a lot of the English-speaking countries, Australia, America, Canada, and quite a lot more than sort of emerging, or not really emerging, but some of the Far Eastern countries like Singapore or China or what have you. So internationally, we're somewhere in the middle, but in Western European terms, actually, we've still got relatively low taxes.
One of the quotes that you use in the book is that we can't have an American tax system is in low taxes and, you know, European public services.
Yeah.
It feels, to me, before reading the book, I would have said we have high taxes and poor public services. That's how it felt.
Well, I think it's one of the problems at the moment is taxes are high by our historic standards, but public services do feel poor. I mean, we've got massive waiting lists in the NHS. Much more than we've had for 25 years, really, in terms of NHS waiting lists. Government's been cutting spending through the 2010s. So it does feel like we've got higher taxes. We do have higher taxes than we've had, and public services are struggling, which is, you know, not a happy place to be in. And part of that is, I say, because we've had really poor economic growth. We're spending so much on debt interest, and we don't see any benefit from paying for debt interest. But if you look, you know, compare our public services with those in the US, actually ours aren't too bad.
A lot better than the ones in the US, definitely. I always say that, people always say the NHS, it's like, it's not very good, it's a long waiting list, but at least we have an NHS and we have, it works just very slowly. So
I recently needed the NHS, and I was in a point where it was like A&E needed a brain scan, and I waited 17 hours. Like, I could have an internal bleed on the brain here while I'm sat here. And I think they've cut the areas of society that you don't know they've been cut until you need them. And then it becomes very obvious. And my whole view of NHS funding and sorting it out shifted in one night, because I basically came out of there going, they're very good at fixing people that are clearly dying. If you might be dying, you wait a long time. And I think I want a system where I can walk in and get fixed quite quick.
And it's missing all of its targets now in a way that, it was getting worse in the years up to the pandemic, but post-pandemic, it's got much, much worse, despite the fact, actually, we're spending more and more on it. And, a bigger and bigger fraction of the total amount we spend is going on the health service. And there's a bit of a mystery, actually. Since 2019, we're employing loads more doctors and nurses and spending much more. The NHS isn't doing any more. And we don't really understand why that is. And that's why the waiting lists keep going up.
So I want to talk about waste in a second. And I would like to pin that point and come back to it, because I think I think we can have an interesting conversation there. Before we get to that, you say in your book, government needs to be brave, and so do we. So I encourage people to listen to this with an open mind, because that's what I had to do. Because like I said, I came into this going, I'm paying way too much tax. And but you set out in the book your logic of why we will need more tax going forwards because of problems that are on the horizon / already here. Could you just outline what you think the challenges are that face the country going forwards in terms of why we need more tax?
Yeah, I mean, I should say, there are always choices here. So we could decide to cut the health service, or, make people pay for their own sixth form, or, dramatically cut pensions, or what have you. So there are always choices. But if we're not going to make those sorts of choices, then there are, I think, two or three big things that are going to happen over the next 20 or 30 years, which are going to mean, even though we've got the highest taxes ever at the moment, I think they may well go up further. One is the population is getting older, and there'll be something like a tripling in the fraction of people who are over the age of 80, and a big increase in the number of people over age 65. And that's expensive, because those are the people who use the health service a lot. And of course, pensions. They get paid pensions. Health service is much bigger, actually, than pensions, but both of those and social care. So all of those things, and of course, on average, they pay less tax than people who are in work. So all of those things will have an upward pressure on spending, and therefore on tax. Second thing, of course, is climate change. And we're committed, quite rightly, to get to net zero by 2050. That's a big, that's a big issue to get to net zero by 2050. We're all going to have to replace our gas boilers in our houses, for example. That's expensive. And that's not the only thing by any means. And that's an extra, let's say, $20 billion a year of government spending, as well as a lot of private spending. And over the last, so that's two things. And over the last decade, I'd say we've had record cuts in spending on social care, on local government spending, on spending on the police, on spending on the justice system. All of those things have had really big cuts. And at most, I can't see more cuts coming there. And you can see the pressures everywhere for more spending. We've had to stop sending people to prison because they're full. We've had strikes by barristers because legal aid is so poor. We're spending no more per pupil in schools than we were 15 years ago, first time that's ever happened. So the pressures everywhere are up. And the bit of public spending, which until 10 years ago, we could always squeeze, which is defence. Well, the government at least has promised to raise that for the first time in generations. And you can see why with what's going on in Ukraine and the problems in the Middle East and sorts of things. Yeah. So put all of those things together, then it seems to me, unless we're willing to say, look, we're going to really ration the NHS even more than we are, or we're going to means test access to the NHS, or we're going to stop providing free school post 16. So all of the pressures seem to me to be upward.
Yeah. And to counter that then, as a as an individual, as I go about my day, it feels like I get taxed on absolutely everything, yep. Bar breathing, right? And
that will come.
Yeah, 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 penny per breath. So let's look at the roads as an example. I pay road tax and then the roads are just a mess. There's potholes everywhere. And I know it's a simple example, but it just seems like a lot of money goes into the system and nothing is right. Mm. Is there waste? Are they just burning money or?
Well, there's certainly some waste. I mean, interesting what you say about road tax. Of course, petrol duty has been coming down year on year on year on year for the last 13 years. And as we move to electric cars, then petrol duty will go altogether. And that's more than 30 billion quid the government is going to lose. So that's sort of by the by. But, you know, it's really hard in the whole public sphere to say, how much waste is there? We've all seen that things could be more efficient. I mean, you go to there's lots of inefficiencies in the NHS, partly because they haven't invested in decent computer systems and decent buildings and decent equipment over a long time. And that partly reflects the fact it always seems to be in an emergency. So the money for the long-term stuff that might save money goes into, you know, the day-to-day stuff that just keeps you alive. As you're saying, in the short run,
yeah.
I mean, there has been waste in bits. I mean, so local government, for example, has had huge cuts after 2010. And I say this quote in the book. I mean, in about 2011 or 2012, I was talking to a chief executive at one of the big local authorities, and he said to me, before 2010, quotes, we were pissing money against the wall, unquote. So there were clearly, in a sense, was too much money sloshing around at that point. But they've really, I mean, they've cut like £1 in five of their spending over the last 15 years. It's pretty hard to think that there's a lot of waste in there, at least things they could easily change. But right across the system, there are ways that this could be done better. It's really, really hard sitting in Whitehall to then sort of, wave a wand or make a law which makes these things more efficient. That's really tough.
So, on that inefficiencies point, are there any areas that you can see that are obvious or quick wins that we could change?
There's nothing big. There's nothing of a scale which would really help us sort out the kinds of problems that we're talking about. There have been mistakes for sure. I mean, we are part of the reason that the NHS doesn't work very well at the moment is we were not investing beforehand in the kinds of equipment and buildings and so on which would make it work better at the moment, and indeed in training the staff. And we know that we need better management in the NHS. We know we need better IT infrastructure and so on. But that's actually going to cost money up front. If I look right across public sector, is there a sort of £10 billion budget where I can see, well, we just don't need that, it's obvious? Well, no, not really.
Politics. Over the last few years, just get rid of all of them. Let you run the country. You and T.
Yeah, just hash it out. Chance of the exchequer over here. Yeah,
you can be my chancellor. Yeah.
Good God.
Do you think, though, that when they're making these laws or they're like creating new taxes, that they actually think about the average person? So, like, for example, you had in your book, you mentioned there was window tax. So people, if you had over seven windows, you got taxed. So they just boarded up some windows. Yep. And it was meant to go to the landlord, but then the landlord just increased the prices of the rent so that it ended up going to the tenants.
Yep.
And then there was brick tax, so people just made bigger bricks, which I thought was really smart.
That's what I do.
So you're charging me per brick. How about this big brick?
That's exactly what they did.
That's what they did. Yeah. And then you said, like, there was like coffin nail tax, beard tax. I would have been hit with the beard tax. So, but then people just shaved their beards or they just like got bigger bricks. So do you think when they're making these laws and we're looking for like where we're going to get more tax, more money, it seems that there's always a loophole that people will try and like, naturally, I don't want to pay as much. Everyone wants to pay less tax.
Yeah.
So do you think they think about it in practice or they just think this is a good idea, let's have a coffin nail tax?
Yeah, I think right across the piece, there isn't that sort of engagement with real life and real people. I mean, in all sorts of ways. I mean, when you talk about how they change the NHS, they don't seem to engage with patients. I mean, we've all wasted huge amounts of our lives not waiting around in hospitals, or if you've ever done jury duty, it's basically spending 2 weeks waiting. So there's no sort of sense of actually caring very much about
people's time.
But on the tax side, you're absolutely right. I mean, there are so many ways, and I go through some of them in the book, where it's just obvious today. There's kind of big signs up saying, please avoid tax here. It's, you know, if you, you'd think that saving in a pension, you'd want to use your money for a pension, but there's a huge inheritance tax loop. Yeah. Which means that it's the easiest way of avoiding inheritance tax is to put money into a pension. That if you, you know, depending on, you know, the reason that companies like Uber and so on would love the drivers to be self-employed is because you pay a lot less tax if they're self-employed. If you're a partner in a, you know, massively well-earning partner in a law firm, you pay less tax as a fraction of your income than if you're an employee. So there are so many ways in which just little changes in behavior kind of change the tax that you pay. And of course, there is therefore, I mean, it's a modern day equivalent of the brick tax that you were talking about. You change this way in which your behavior, this way in how your income looks, and you pay a different amount of tax. And not surprisingly, people make a lot of effort to do that. And you know, big companies, I mean, kind of incredibly complex things in order to achieve that.
But you seem to explain it really well in your book. Can't the government just listen to your advice? Like, it seems like you make it sound really simple and like common sense. At least you can see the problems. Yeah. Maybe not have the solutions.
I think I do have the solutions. The problem, and this is what I was saying about being brave earlier, is that all of these solutions involve someone getting worse off. Because if there's currently something which says that if you declare yourself a company as opposed to an employee, you pay less tax, you have to increase tax. I mean, council tax is appalling tax and very regressive. But if you change it, people with expensive properties will pay more and they complain, obviously. And we see that. I mean, it's some time ago that George Osborne tried to, you know, put VAT on sort of hot takeaway pasties. And that, you know, it was a tiny change.
I remember but
there was
that.
I mean, that sort of
Damien loves his Greggs. He was definitely hit by that.
Even little changes are sort of really unpopular. And there are, I mean, throughout the system, I mean, we know that if we really cared about sort of young people and housing and economic growth, we would loosen the planning laws, for instance. But of course, that makes people who have got, you know, nice houses in the countryside worse off. And that they're the people who seem to have the power. So I think the truth is that government knows a lot of this stuff, but is scared to make the change because there are almost no changes that you can make which just make everyone better off. Most of them will make someone worse off, and they tend to shout quite loud.
You spoke about tax reforms, was it the 80s or 90s, that were actually sensible, and the government lost power as a result of them because people just don't like change in... They don't like to hear that taxes are changing, even if it will benefit them or is good for the country.
Yeah, so I mean, there's lots of examples of that. This is where I'm going to lose the audience completely. Back in the 1990s, the then government tried to put VAT at its full rate on gas and electricity. Now, at the moment, most things have 20% VAT, gas and electricity have 5%. That's another way of saying that if we want to get to net zero, but we're actually subsidizing people using gas.
Yeah.
And obviously rich people use a lot more gas than poor people. So you could put VAT on it and increase benefits for people on lower incomes and cut taxes, exactly what the government of the day said they would do, make people on low incomes on average better off and people on high incomes on average worse off, and stop subsidizing us burning gas. It was possibly, it's about the most unpopular policy ever. Didn't happen. It was one of the reasons the government became incredibly unpopular. And that's just one example of how hard it is to change something. At the moment, we effectively subsidize people who spend an enormous amount of money on gas and electricity. Now, part of the problem is, of course, I said on average you can compensate poor people, people on low incomes. You can't completely compensate all of them. So there will be some people on low incomes who've got very hard to heat houses or who have a particular medical needs, which mean that they have to keep their house very warm. So we'll make some people worse off. But at the moment, because we're spending so much on this, we're making lots of people worse off because we're raising taxes in other ways.
It's taxed to shape behaviour, which is... the beard tax and things like that, everyone shaves. Actually, the use for tax is to to shape behavior and push people ways. Because like you say, if you tax over here, they'll move over there.
Yeah.
So if you want to go to net zero, you have to tax gas usage and maybe incentivize electric on the other side so that
exactly.
behavior moves that way. The one takeaway that I took from the book though is, we talk about beer tax and all of that. None of them really matter. There's three taxes mm-hmm. that move the needle. Can you just mm-hmm. explain to us what those taxes are?
Yeah, so we raise about £1 trillion, just under £1 trillion a year. That's a big number in yeah. tax. and about two-thirds of that nearly is just from three taxes: income tax, national insurance contributions, and VAT. The next biggest one is corporation tax. So between those, that's more
I pay all of those.
Two-thirds of the... excellent. Well done. But well, we're very grateful.
Yeah, you say you are welcome.
Cheers,
you
Dara.
Are welcome.
But you would think corporation tax would be a bit higher.
It's quite
no,
hard. It's...
No. Leave it alone.
So we get whatever it is, a $250 billion or something from income tax, and getting on for $200 billion from national insurance and VAT. Corporation tax actually going up quite a lot. And by international standards, it's really quite high. That surprises sure. people in terms of what we get in the UK, but it's still only... what, less than about a fifth of what we get from income tax, a bit more than a fifth. So it's those three big ones: national insurance, which you pay on your earnings, income tax you pay on your income, VAT you pay when you buy stuff. Those are the three big ones. Income tax at the moment, people may not realize this, income tax at the moment is going up by the most it has ever gone up.
Fiscal drag.
So what that means is the point at which you start to pay income tax is being held at the same level in cash terms for 6 years when inflation is really high. So that drags more and more of your income into tax. And the point at which you start to pay higher rate tax, just over £50,000, it's also being held for 6 years. And that's doubling the number of people who are going to be higher rate taxpayers. And the point at which you start to pay 60% tax, which you do between £100,000 and £125,000, and 45% tax over £125,000, all of those are being held. And that's probably a £50 billion tax rise. Now, that's one of the biggest tax rises in history. But you don't kind of notice it because it's just holding things the same in cash terms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's this point of being a higher rate taxpayer used to mean something. Now you can actually be... in poverty as a higher rate taxpayer, you know, you could afford not be able to afford to live and still be in the higher rates.
Well, I think, again, this is one of the funny things about tax. I mean, if you are a single person with no children and small housing costs, obviously £50,000 a year and you're really well off. Mm. If you're a sort of single earner with a mortgage and two or three children, £50,000 really isn't very much. Mm. And of course, the tax system doesn't take account of those differences. So you'll pay the same amount of tax either way.
It punishes people in certain circumstances. Your book highlighted, I would like you to explain it, but if you say have three children and you're going from 50 to 60K in income, you're paying, is it like 68% or something?
Something like that. You're paying really high. So the reason is that your child benefit, which you get if your income's below 50,000, is taxed away between 50,000 and 60,000 pounds. So if you've got two or three children, that's a reasonable amount of money which you gradually lose as your income goes up between 50 and 60,000. And that can take your marginal tax rate, so the amount you lose for every pound that you earn, well above 60, and if you've got enough children, 70%.
So you're saying to us that an aging population is an issue, but we're disincentivizing people to have children in a common income bracket. You're probably going to just say, yeah, but shouldn't we be incentivizing people to have children then instead and not impacting that? Because they'll make financial decisions. People will say, of our generation, I'm not going to have kids because it's too expensive.
Yeah.
And that's a reflection of that, isn't it?
Well, I think it is. I mean, I think the bigger issues there are around housing costs and so on. I mean, if you look, 25 years ago, the large majority of middle-income people in their 30s who had children were owner-occupiers. Now, a big fraction of them are private renting. And private renting, as everyone will know, is really expensive and has all sorts of other downsides. And it's definitely one of the things that makes it, when you make that calculus, am I going to have a kid? How many kids am I going to have? The housing cost is really important. The childcare costs are really important. Possibly the child benefit, but that's not, that's actually quite small probably relative to your housing costs and your childcare costs. But all of those things matter. And the number of kids that we're having is dropping really quite fast. I mean, it's about one point. So the way that we measure this is how many children per woman in their lifetime. And you need 2.1 to just keep the population stable if you ignore immigration. We're only having 1.6 at the moment, which probably is the lowest ever. And you know, the only reason that the population is reasonably sort of stable at working age is because we've got quite a large number of immigrants.
Yeah, I mean, you've just had a kid.
I'm not having any more.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, thank
you've
you.
Got one.
When I grew up, though, I thought I'm going to have four. But I come from a big family, so I thought when I grew up, I'm like, oh, I want to have twin boys. Then I want to have
twin
like
boys?
Four.
You got to specify that.
I did. But I don't know what I want. I go for it.
Well, I've got twin boys.
You see, there you go.
There you go. Yeah.
Shoot to kill.
Put it out there. But I always thought I had like two twins and then like a couple others. So at least three or four kids. I've had one and I'm like, no, done. Way. I'm done. You, done because you, it's just, it just changes your life, but it's more expensive now to have a kid than it was before.
Well,
not even
about
talking
it,
about school fees, just like maintenance and food and nursery and everything.
Yeah.
It just costs.
Try having a 10 years old is an expensive age. Yeah, my son, like, you know, they don't get cheaper. I'd say when they're a baby.
To a university at the moment, they're blooming expensive. So
So keep having kids, people.
Even university used to be free. Like when we were growing up, university was,
the loan doesn't cover
It was free. And then
the loan doesn't cover the costs is the problem. So, you know, you have to supplement your child or they have to work, don't they? Because the grant and the loan isn't enough to even pay the accommodation.
Whereas before
basically.
You could just go and have fun and party and not worry about it. Now it's like, I need some money, parents. I need a loan. I just paid off my student loan, thankfully. But yeah, it's just a lot of work.
Not the one that you've defaulted on. You took out a digital
but now they don't
charge interest on it.
Yeah, because they stopped charging interest after you stopped making the payments.
When you default.
It was my second degrees. Yeah, so I took a private loan.
I'm old enough not to have had to pay anything.
It's that lack of investment in the future. It's that short-term mindset that we're not investing in kids' educations. We charge loads for university, straddling people with debt. It all seems backwards, doesn't it, the thinking?
Well, I think one of the things, again, I say in the book is that the biggest thing that worries me about COVID is what's happened to kids' education. Mm. I mean, a lot of kids lost a lot of education, and we know that there's particularly poorer kids are not going back to school full time in the way that they used to. So I think all of the rest of it will pass. I mean, the sort of the health issues and the economic issues and so on. But the effect on that generation of young people, and particularly those from particular backgrounds who aren't going back to school properly, and the government's invested very, very, very little in sort of dealing with that. That, I think, might be the biggest cost that we see in 10, 20 years' time.
Yeah, so just the intelligence cost or the education cost.
Loss of education. Yeah. We know that, you know, having a good... I mean, the most important thing for any individual and for the country is that we have a good education system. People get the skills and the education, the literacy and the numeracy and all those things. And if you lose that, I mean, we know this just from research, right? You can actually see it in the data that if you don't get that education, then you'll end up worse off and the country will end up worse off.
Can you guess what the biggest learning has been from doing this podcast or even my YouTube channel? It's that the most important investment you can make is in you. So for me, my path to real wealth isn't through investing, it's by building this business. And that's why I'm happy that we're working with Hostinger. Hostinger help entrepreneurs, freelancers and side hustlers with their websites. My favourite thing is their AI website builder, which helps anyone create a professional website with zero coding experience. You just describe your goal in a couple of sentences and the AI creates a beautiful looking website just like magic. You can then customise it, use the AI assistant to generate SEO friendly text and even use their AI logo maker. It's fast, user friendly, and of course what I like the best is it's great value for money. You can get website hosting and a free domain from £2.99 a month. So if you want a website, then check out Hostinger. And if you use the code MAKINGMONEY, that's making money all one word, you'll get 10% off. And I've left a link in the description for you. Before I became a creator, I was a sales guy. I mean, I love selling. It's how I rebuilt my life after some wrong turns in my 20s. I also delivered Chinese takeaways on the side, but that was more fun money, so I could go out on a night without feeling guilty. Sales was where the real money was at. And one tool that I found really useful was LinkedIn Sales Navigator. It's a sales intelligence platform that helps you identify and then get into conversations with high-value customers so you can drive more revenue. You can use it to look for key signals like recent job changes, so you can find buyers who are most likely to convert. And because they've got a billion people on the platform, I mean, the chances are your targets are going to be on LinkedIn. Sales Navigator gives you the most up-to-date, first-party data so you can get into conversations with the people that matter. So if you want to give Sales Navigator a try, you can get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/upsell. That's linkedin.com/UPSELL for a 60-day free trial.
We know that the three biggest taxes, income tax, VAT, we know that everyone's paying more at the minute. Can we just tackle the thing that I know everyone's screaming at home is, why don't we just tax the wealthy more?
Yeah, so it's always great, isn't it? You know, don't tax me, don't tax you, don't tax me, tax that tax man tea. Behind the tree. Someone else, always tax someone else. Tax T, absolutely.
Yeah, tax T. That's it. You're not finding me.
You're behind the tree, aren't you?
With all my crypto in behind the tree, deciding, like, don't tax me, please.
Well, we can do a bit more of that, but I think some things it's really worth keeping in mind. Because if you look at income tax, 1% of people pay 30% of income tax already. So we're getting a lot of tax from people on high incomes. That's partly because their incomes are pretty high, but we get a lot. And we get more, actually, than most European countries from the people at the top. Again, partly because people at the top are quite well off. 1%, we're talking about incomes over 160,000 or something before tax. That's the top 1%. The top 0.1%, they've got incomes over about 650,000. There's about 50,000 people in that group. They're paying, just 0.1% are paying about 6 or 7% of all income tax. So about 6.
You mean taxable income? So like a wage, income. Basically, yeah, or a salary?
Or income from self-employment or whatever.
Okay, yeah.
So that's a huge number. I mean, yeah. You know, there's not very many people earn that amount of money, but they pay an awful lot of tax. Although one of the things that, you know, is frustrating in a sense, is that they're much more likely to get their money from sources which are less highly taxed. So they're more likely to be self-employed, or they're more likely to be company owner managers or what have you. And they pay less tax than, you know, wage slaves like me, who just pay income tax and national insurance. Second thing about that group is that about a third of them were born abroad. So I never used to think this was a real issue, but we now, a third, so they could leave. And that would be expensive for us. So that's the first thing. We get
they
a lot from
here,
people on high income.
Go.
They could go.
Yeah.
I mean, if we do, yeah, I mean, there's lots of things we could do to chase them away, like leaving the European Union or what have you. But in terms of wealth, so that's income. So that's people on high incomes. We get a lot from them, but and we probably get a bit more, but not enough to move the dial. In terms of wealth, I think that's where we could look. So wealth has become much more important relative to income over the last 20 or 30 years. House prices have gone up, asset values have gone up. An older generation is sitting on quite a lot of wealth, and wealth is much more unequally distributed than income. And we don't have a sort of specific wealth tax, but more importantly, the wealth taxes we do have work really badly. So inheritance tax, for example, doesn't raise very much money, partly because if you're really rich, it's really easy to avoid it.
A trust or
a trust or just, you know, just buy shares in the AIM market, in the sort of small company
or farmland
market,
or
farmland, yeah. Any of those things. And so I've got a little quote in there from this great tax lawyer called Dan Needle. He says, you know, you go to your advisor, how do I reduce my inheritance tax? And you expect a kind of, you know, 30-page thing, and you just come back saying, sell the assets you've got, buy some shares on the AIM market, live 2 years, that's it. No inheritance tax. And so the result is that the average level of inheritance tax on a £2 million inheritance is double what it is on a £10 million inheritance. And if you've got billions, you pay almost none. So you can do a lot to fix that.
Council tax, you highlighted as a wealth tax. And this was the first time I'd thought about it, but can you just explain that, please?
So council tax is a tax based on the value of your property that you live in, but the value as it was in 1991, so more than 30 years ago. And the amount that you pay is a higher fraction of that value, the lower the value of your house. So if you've got a really cheap house, mostly in the north of England, you pay three times as much as a fraction of the value of your property as if you're in a quite expensive house in London, say. And because there's a cap on the amount you pay, if you're in a £100 million mansion, you pay the same as someone who's in a sort of standard, well, in London at least, standard £1 million house. That didn't used to be the case. Under the old rate system, there was no cap on it, and you had sort of the amount directly related to the value of the property. So I think this is the only tax we've got, which I think is deliberately regressive in the sense that the wealthier you are, the less you pay as a fraction of your wealth.
And it could be a genuine, easily enforceable wealth tax, because one thing about wealth, like to you know, argue the other side, someone like Elon Musk hasn't got billions in the bank. It's tied up in stock value. So, you know, if you're saying, oh, I want 10% of your wealth, what does he do? Does he dump 10% of Tesla stock on the open market?
Well, I mean, he lost more than 10% buying Twitter, didn't he?
Ben? Yeah, yeah, X. Yeah. Yeah, he does a good job of burning his own cash. I mean, I say that, the guy's worth a lot of money, so he does a good job of earning it. But with council tax, it's like, oh, you're living in a £15 million house, you've got to pay, you know, £100,000 a year to live in it. That seems quite fair. It's crazy that I pay more council tax than some people who live in Mayfair, you know, living up north in where I live.
Yeah. It's completely crackers. And there are actually still places where the council tax in cash terms today is less than the rates were, which is what preceded council tax, 35 years ago. And so if you're on a really expensive, you know, place in central London, you're paying, I don't know, £2,000 or £3,000 a year. The US, which is hardly, you know, the hotbed of socialism, most areas in the US have property taxes, which are much, much bigger than that on really expensive properties.
You use an example, was it Hartlepool, where the person pays like 1 or 2% of the value of their home every year?
Yeah, and in Westminster it's 0.1%.
0.1%.
So it impacts 10 times heavier on Hartlepool than it does on Westminster.
That's madness, isn't it?
That's wild.
Are there any other taxes like that where you think this could be an easy fix?
So capital gains tax. Again, it doesn't raise huge amounts, but it raises a significant amount. It's a tax as you'd want. I mean, if you buy something and it becomes more valuable and then you sell it, then you pay some tax on that gain. Actually, historically, that was one of the reasons 20 years ago when Gordon Brown unaccountably really cut capital gains tax. People in private equity were able to pay sort of 10% tax, whereas other people were paying 40% tax, and they were able to claim, I mean, this was in the press at the time, I pay a lower rate of tax than my cleaner, and this is kind of, you know, multimillionaires. That's not quite as bad as that anymore, but there's only a 10% capital gains tax on business disposal up to £1 million. That benefits a small number of very wealthy people. And if you hold on to something until you die, there's no capital gains tax at all. And that does mean that a lot of people who would, you know, probably benefit from selling their second home or their shares or what have you, just hold on to them to avoid the tax. And then when it's passed on, there's no tax. That's both unfair and actually economically inefficient as well.
You had a good analysis of corporation tax. You said like companies like Amazon or like Apple, they might have their like R&D in America and then they build everything in like China, but then they sell the like iPhone in London.
Yep.
But because you can't really say it's a tax on the profit they make, right? So you can't really say where the profits actualize.
Yep.
But you said that instead of taxing, so a lot of companies will choose, we'll pay the tax in Ireland or somewhere where it's cheaper. Do you think it would just make more sense if everyone just said, okay, if you sell in England, you have to pay tax in England. If you sell, would that work? Or do you think all the corporations would be like, no, we want to keep paying, naturally, we want to keep paying our tax in Ireland or Singapore, wherever it's cheaper, where we make the product?
I think in the long run, a move in that direction would, you know, is probably the way to go. I mean, the problem is exactly as you describe it. Corporation tax is supposed to be a tax on profits. But when you're looking at Apple or Amazon, where is the profit made? And you know, the corporation tax system is an international system, and it was sort of still based on rules made in the 1920s, so 100 years ago, when that wasn't so hard. I mean, you know, you didn't have internet companies and these incredibly complex supply chains. So it's exactly right, and you know, there is, that's why, you know, lawyers and accountants and international sort of bodies, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of people making a lot of money out of determining where profits are made, and there's no correct answer to where the profit is made. And as you say, is it just because of the R&D? Is it where it's sold? Is it where it's made? So you could sweep all of that away and say, look, actually, we're just going to tax you according to where the sales are, because we can see where the sales are. Of course, that needs some international agreement, and of course, some countries would win, and some countries would lose. And that's why that's quite hard to achieve.
It hasn't been reformed since 1920. It hasn't been updated.
It's been up. I mean, there's been lots of effort into sort of fixing the holes and updating it and make it more and more and more complex. But the basis of it is still the same.
Yeah, because America's incentivized to keep the system as it is, because they benefit these massive corporations. A lot of them are American, aren't they?
And
they're
selling the biggest ones. Yeah. And so there are some reforms going ahead, and the Americans essentially are saying if everyone in the world will at least ensure there's a 15% minimum corporation tax rate, then we will allow you to tax a little bit more of some of these American companies' profits in your own country. So that's the sort of quid pro quo. They want to make sure, you know, that they get rid of the sort of more egregious sort of tax havens. And if you do that, then some countries can charge a little bit more tax. But this is, you know, they've been negotiating this for 10 years and it's still not in place.
So this leads me on to another question I'd like to ask you. You're talking about, you know, agreements internationally, which kind of makes me think about policing of the tax system as well. In the sense of, another YouTuber friend of mine has just had the tax man all over him. And there was a month-long discussion about a coffee maker. But then the government have recently said about furlough and all the fraud that exists around there. We're just going to wipe that. How do you view the policing of the tax system, and do you see that as fair?
That's a really complicated area. I mean, it's extraordinary, isn't it, that thing about the furlough. So through COVID, the government spent vast amounts of money, hundreds of billions of pounds, I mean, like in a way that's never happened before. And actually, the British government spent more than most other governments. And Rishi Sunak, when he was Chancellor, seemed to be very proud of that. Obviously, we needed to spend a lot, but it's pretty clear in some ways we spent too much. So furlough went on for longer than it should have done. For example, we wasted a lot of money on PPE, personal protective equipment, for example. But the fraud mostly appears to have occurred where loans were made to businesses, things called bounce back loans. They're made through the banks, but the government told the banks, look, essentially, lend to whoever you want and we'll pay you back. And quite a lot of people got rich off the back of that. Quite a lot of that, billions and billions, is, you know, government admits was fraud and appears to have effectively given up on trying to get it back. And actually, they were warned at the time about some of these loans that they were giving. But that's by the by. I think if you've got a tax system, you need to police it. And again, one of the things I quote in there was one of the many mad things that Kwasi Kwarteng did when he was chancellor was to essentially say we're going to stop policing whether it's self-employment income or whether it's earned income. And the Treasury
That's the IR35.
IR35, exactly. And the Treasury said, well, that'll cost you $2 billion a year. And that was the Treasury's estimate. But if you've got a tax, I mean, the answer really is to tax everyone the same and you wouldn't need all these rules. But if you've got these rules, then you need to police it.
Yeah, so we were speaking off camera before and I told you that I worked in accountancy and I actually worked for contractor-based accountancy. So I oversaw the transition of IR35. I saw it get undone. I saw it transition again. And then I seen them threaten to undo it. And just to give people context on what that was, it's a perfect example as well of you saying before that people get hurt and they don't like it. But people, we would have cleaners who are contractors or doctors working in the NHS, working through a limited company and not paying high levels of tax, maybe 10%. But then a full-time member of staff next to them doing the exact same job was paying 30, 40%, whatever. So the IR35 rules tried to close that loophole where people who were just employees were contractors working through limited companies. It was really unfair because what was the incentive to be full-time employed when you could just...
Yeah. Yeah, and this is why people like Gary Lineker have spent years in the courts fighting with HMRC about whether they were an employee of the BBC or whether they were doing it through their own company. And I think he's recently won that case. But I mean, it's for people like that, there's lots of money at stake, and you know, it's just a kind of small legal technicality. Depends on that whether you're paying millions more tax or not.
Yeah.
You can see immediately that that's a cracker's tax system.
Yeah. Yeah. So I still think it's a hard message to swallow in terms of we're all going to pay more tax or we all need to pay more tax. Do you have a positive way of reassuring people that that's a good thing or that it's going to be okay?
well, look, we all want to pay less tax, don't we? I mean, I'd much rather pay less tax than more tax. I mean, I suppose one answer is you go to places like Denmark, where they've got much higher taxes than us. And on average, they're pretty happy about that, because that does seem to pay for sort of social equity and good public services and so on. I think the problem here is exactly as you were saying earlier on, is that these high tax levels seem to pay for pretty rubbish public services at the moment. And whilst that continues, then I think people are going to continue to be a bit unhappy. Also, when it just looks unfair. I mean, we've talked about how super rich people tend to avoid inheritance tax. You can use capital gains tax to avoid income tax. You can partners in law firms pay less tax than employees. So part of the answer is, if you're going to have more tax, it's even more important to sort of tidy up the tax system so that it's fair and it works efficiently and it's not too complex and all of those sorts of things. I mean, all those things matter anyway, but the more that you rely on tax, the more that it's going to matter for economic growth as well as people feeling that it's fair.
Speaking of growth, how does growth in the UK impact this taxation point? And, is growth an answer?
Well, we certainly need growth. So so one of the reasons that we're in the position we are at the moment is that incomes and growth have been so poor over the last 15 years. I mean, one of the extraordinary things, if you look at earnings growth, the last 15 years have probably been the worst 15 years since Napoleon. I mean, going back to when we income taxes first. So literally the worst 15 years for 200 years in terms of earnings and income growth, which is just extraordinary. And of course, if they're not growing, then tax revenues aren't coming in. And the less money we have as a country, the less money we've got to spend on health and education and so on and so on. So more growth matters in all sorts of ways. It's also one of the reasons why we've got this sort of intergenerational inequity that sort of older people who owned their houses 15 years ago have done so much better than younger people, because very low interest rates, which reflects the very poor growth, and earnings haven't gone up. So all of those things matter. So going forward, economic growth is important for us feeling better about the world, but also in order to be able to pay more tax for the better public services. And actually, if you've got the same tax as a fraction of national income, buys you more if there's more national income.
Yeah. Yeah, so like you point to Scandinavian countries and they earn a lot more per capita or on average than say we do, don't they, as well? So
yeah, so they've got lots more to spend on their public tax, services. Yeah. Now obviously if you've got more income as a country, you have to pay your doctors and nurses and teachers and policemen and so on more, because you can't have them falling further and further behind. So it's not all a win in terms of things just get easier, but it obviously helps.
So how do we grow?
A phrase I use in there is there's a dirty little secret in Whitehall, which is that they know how to do it and don't do it. So we know how to get growth in the long run. And that's a political problem, because you can't do stuff today which will make a difference in a year's time to growth in a way that's sustainable. But you can do stuff over the next 3 years which will make a big difference in 10 years. So there's that's the political problem, because politicians don't tend to have that sort of time span. But what are the things we could do that we know would be good for growth? Well, one is reform the planning system so we can actually build houses where they're needed and build roads where they're needed and so on. Governments have continually bottled out of that the last time.
Infrastructure investment.
Well, so infrastructure investment as well. I'm not so sure about HS2, but we can come back to that.
Southerners. Southerners. You get on that train, that Avanti West Coast train, be sat next to the toilet and tell me we don't need more capacity on that line.
Well, capacity perhaps, or whether HS2 is the best way of doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, my kids are at University of Manchester, so I'm on that train quite a lot.
Yeah. I went there. So you end up standing on a Sunday, you stand there with like no seats.
That's the best bit of the train. And then go, regional in, to Barrow and Furness.
But that's why, you definitely need infrastructure across the north and across the Midlands. So one of the things outside of London, our cities are much worse served by transport than in Europe. So European cities have much better public transport, and American cities tend to have much better roads, and we're stuck. So that means that Birmingham, Manchester and so on, effectively, they're serving a much smaller labour market than they could, because people can't get in to work. So that's one thing that really matters. Planning, infrastructure investment, and we cut spending on investment dramatically in the early 2010s, and we're paying the costs of that. Education, we know, really matters for growth, particularly, and this is a real sort of bugbear of mine, for 60, people between 16 and 21 who aren't doing A-levels and going to university, which is about half. We really cut spending on that. Policy has been totally changing all of the time. And our 15-year-olds actually compare quite well internationally. Our 21-year-olds are disastrous internationally. And that's telling you something really serious about what's going wrong between 16 and 21, particularly for people doing vocational.
So higher education and apprenticeships, is that what you mean?
Further education and apprenticeships, yeah. We have very few people doing higher level apprenticeships. So lots of people do degrees and lots of people sort of stop at sort of GCSE or A-level. Almost nobody does stuff in between. Actually, one of my sons did a sort of higher level apprenticeship doing really well. And we know that there are big gaps in skills at exactly those levels. So that will be good for growth. We know that. We've talked about reforming the tax system in ways that would be good for growth. We know that will be, we know that's important. And there's all sorts of things we need to do with, you know, trade with Europe. I mean, we know that making trade more expensive with our biggest, nearest and richest trading partner is bad for growth. So the closer we can get to the single market, the customs union, the better. And then there's lots of issues around competition law and regulation and just getting all of those right. So we kind of know the broad outline of things that we need to do to get growth going. But each one of those things is either expensive or it's bad for people who've already got houses somewhere, or you know, it's a bit difficult when it comes to education, or it makes some people worse off when it comes to tax. And so there are always trade-offs. And if there's one theme of my book, it's there are always trade-offs. There are not very many things you can do which makes
easy decision.
Everyone better off. But my view is that we've made the wrong trade-offs for a long period of time, which is partly why we're in the position we're in.
Do you think Brexit made this a lot worse? Or not in the grand scheme of things?
It certainly had an effect. So we're probably 3 or 4% worse off than if we hadn't, or will be, than if we hadn't gone through Brexit. Now, that is a decision you can make. I mean, we're a rich country, despite everything we've just been saying. And if you know, and then there are, you know, does mean, it genuinely means we can control our immigration, for example, in a way that we couldn't within the European Union. So there are trade-offs. There are arguably benefits, but there are costs, and the costs are economic ones, because we can see that our trade intensity has fallen a lot, and we could see immediately after the referendum that investment fell off. So we know that there are economic costs, and you have to weigh those against any political benefits that you might see from it. And one of the huge frustrations of referendums, both that one and the Scottish one actually, is that both sides made out that everything will be best on one, but there are there are always trade-offs.
No nuance to the debate. Like, it's all good over here, or it's
exactly,
all good over there.
Exactly.
Do you have much confidence that the political system will, you know, make the changes that we need for growth? Or can they? Because people are not brave, like you said.
Well, I think it is possible. We have seen over history changes that have been made. I mean, there have been good changes to the tax system over time. We have had reforms to, you know, taxation of mortgages, to capital gains and so on over time. We have had some efforts to change planning. We have had periods. Actually, now is a period when investment spending is quite high. So there are things that people have done. I think what you need, and what one of the problems is we're doing this in 2023, and for the last, certainly between 2016 and 2022, there was just no space. I mean, you talk to cabinet ministers at the time, for 4 years after the 2016 Brexit vote, no one thought about anything other than Brexit in government. You couldn't do anything. And then we had the chaos of COVID, and we've had sort of, you know, Johnson and Corbyn and all this kind of stuff. It does feel to me like we're getting, despite all of the, we're speaking on the day that, you know, we're having a reshuffle and Suella Braverman's just been sacked and so on. So you get all, there's lots of excitement in politics. But despite all of that, it does feel to me like we're returning to a sort of more stable world.
It only took 5-6 years or however long it's been.
And actually, one of the things that is absolutely necessary for economic success and growth is to have stable politics. So when you've got, you know, whatever we had, 4 chancellors in a few months and 3 prime ministers, and actually also when you've got prime ministers saying, you know, fuck business and are trying to undermine the Bank of England and all of those kinds of things, that might feel it's fun from a political point of view, that is economically damaging. So actually having stable politics is it's not enough, but it's absolutely necessary for having economic growth. And hopefully we'll return to a period of more stable politics.
So just to summarise everything you've said there, there are big challenges that the country face, and I think they're important challenges that everyone acknowledges we need to address: ageing population and climate change. In order to do that, it's going to cost money and we will need to pay more taxes. The main levers for tax are really the three big ones, and everything else like inheritance tax and that, we can tweak it and move it to make the system fairer, but they're not going to pull the levers like we need the big three. And really your book says that if we're going to fix these issues long term, that we probably will all pay more tax over the next 10 years. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, and we can do better with all the spending that we're doing. We do better with the education spending especially. But also we need to get the economy growing, and there are things that we can do to do that. But actually that's going to take not just politicians to be brave, that's also going to take us to be brave and actually accept that if you're going to make big choices that we made to make in the long run, let me say it again, there are trade-offs. Yeah. And none of this is straightforward.
I don't want to speak on behalf of the nation, but I think people could probably get behind the idea of paying a bit more tax as long as the system is fairer and we close off the silly loopholes of which penalise people for having more kids and stuff, and we aggressively go after fraud and we tax businesses more and we make sure that the wealthy, the 0.1% pay their share, then maybe we could all pitch in and get tea on that as well.
Chancellor of the Exchequer tea.
Your book is fantastic. You're even better in person. Honestly, I've loved this chat. I'd encourage everyone to get a copy of the book or the audio book. And if there's one key takeaway from it as well, is if you're going to get a pet, get a rabbit because you can eat it, so there's no VAT on it.
Absolutely.
Bunnies on a bagel, mate. Once Floppy pops his clogs, you just spread them on a bagel.
Bugs Bunny for lunch, let's go.
Yeah, that's what I took away from it. If you missed anything in that episode, don't worry. We do a really good summary of everything that's gone on and what we discussed in our newsletter. You can sign up using the link in the description.
And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and leave us a review. It really makes a difference and lets us know what we're doing right.
We're taking a break over Christmas, but we'll put out some special festive treats for you, so keep your eyes peeled for those. We're going to be back on January the 1st to bring in the new year with our full-length episodes. I'm Damo.
I'm T.
The episode was recorded by Jack Hobbs. It was produced and edited by Ruth Edwards. Johnny Hunter is in charge of all our marketing, and it's all brought together by Will Stollerman.
Here at Mindset Win, we want to give you the tools to become better at what you do.
Taking inspiration and wisdom from our guests, we will hear stories, strategies, tips, and tricks.
Told by leading names in sport and beyond.
Who know what it takes to get to the very top.
There will be two episodes each week, packed with amazing stories and practical takeaways for us all to follow.
Search for Mindset Win on YouTube and on your favorite podcast app.